From the Roots Up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. We have lots of interesting material as I came to the station. More news arrived than I could handle almost. First off, let's go from the latest to the other. Chrystia Freeland has stepped down from the cabinet and is an MP, which I think, guess everybody assumes that she will run for the leadership. She was asked not, according to her, she was asked to not continue as the finance minister, and she was offered something else, but conscience told her that she should retreat to her as an MP and wage whatever kind of battle she wishes to wage. And we're very glad that her name is in the news, because that's, we want to talk about her ourselves, because at 11:30 today, we're going to be talking to Anne Charney, who is the author of a terrific novel, Dobried. It's a memoir with some alterations to facilitate the story, I guess we're going to say. Anne Charney was a child in Ukraine, Western Ukraine, when the Germans invaded. And there was a holocaust of bullets, as it is said. And she and her mother and her aunt and cousin barely survived. A remarkable story. And we, of course, are interested to talk to Anne Charney because Peter McFarlane, in his book Family Ties, with the title How a Ukrainian Nazi and a Living Witness Link Canada to Ukraine Today. The Nazi he's referring to is Chrystia Freeland's grandfather. And we always talk about this because she doesn't. That's we want to know about what they call integrity in politics. There used to be a thing called the character issue. Now that we've had Bill Clinton and Richard Nixon, I guess you could say, and of course Donald Trump, character seems to be an issue of little interest, and instead it's just mud and gore. I guess we should mention Al Gore while we're at it. This is, as I said, the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. At any rate, at 11:30, we'll be talking about the story of two families from Western Ukraine, and how one of them was welcome in Canada, the other, the victim of Nazism, had a great deal of difficulty getting here. So that'll be coming up. The other big story, I don't know how big they're playing it in media, and I want to thank Brendan Stone for telling me about all this, is that we do have a statement from former president or president, I don't know how you're supposed to define him, Assad of Syria. And it's been a mystery, been for about a week now, maybe more, as to why and the circumstances under which he stepped down and left Syria. We know he's in Russia. And I'll just summarize what I know. He is saying that he never, on his own volition, decided to leave, that he found himself in circumstances where they were attempting to resist the army and state of Syria under Assad, attempting to resist this new force that was cobbled together by the Turkey, the United States, and Israel to remove him. It came from Idlib. It is made up of combination of some Syrians, mostly actually mercenaries of various types who call themselves by revolutionary names or really complicated names. Almost all of them have changed their names. The leader was an al-Qaeda leader. He is a wanted man, $10 million on his head. That's, of course, the American way. They always put, you know, wanted dead or alive. They always turn everything into American Westerns. If you want America, understand the psychology of the people who rule America, watch the Westerns, because they always have black hat, white hat, and shoot 'em ups and hideous falsification of reality. At any rate, this force was very well organized this time, probably because of the tutelage of the Turkish army and other elements. So Assad's position was that for the clarity of the story, he said he went to, as it became clear that the army was not fighting to resist the incursion from Idlib, which is a part of Syria, by the way, had been occupied for about 8 years or so by terrorist elements. Yeah, they're terrorists. The United Nations said they are. The U.S. said they are. Now, they've been turned into rebels. Whether they are what they actually are will be determined by what they do. You know the proverb, I hear what you say, but I see what you do. So we're going to have to see what they do. But at any rate, Assad said that he says in his statement, I guess you can find it online, please look at it. By the way, do get the full statement, for crying out loud. This will be cherry-picked, and the New York Times will quote maybe 10 words that they can manipulate and turn in the opposite direction or to belittle somebody. That's a trick. Never take, if there's a statement, read the statement, top to bottom. And it is available. I can't say with certainty that it is officially his, because when you have a situation like you have in Syria today, it is deliberately made murky. To come back to the point, he said that he went to Latakia, which would be sort of his home area. It's an area people call where the majority is Alawi. And not to put too much stress on it, the Alawi are a distinct people within Syria, a distinct faith group. And there is also where there was a Russian base. He went to that base hoping to coordinate, or believing he was going to be coordinating defense of the government. But when he arrived, he says in his statement, when he arrived, he found that the Russian military was making a decision based on attacks on them that this was not going to be sustainable, that he be there. It was their decision. This is Assad's attributed statement. It was their decision. He's not criticizing the decision. The problem becomes logistics. If you're in one place, how do you go to the next one and without running into problems that you won't be able to handle? It was clear that the army the old word was defected, I guess. That part he doesn't clarify, but he said that the army had been in retreat. He thought they were going to rally. And the Russians told him, it's best you go to Russia, that we take you with us out of here. I think that's a wise decision, because a kind of bloodlust comes into people and hysteria. And there is a kind of sickness particularly in the West, the wanting to see people destroyed, literally, and we saw what they did to Muammar Gaddafi, one of the ugliest scenes that's available. You can see what happened. Remember, Muammar Gaddafi was one of the most beloved leaders in Africa because he really, his philosophy said we have to do everything we can for the African National Congress, for Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela regarded him as a personal friend. He provided them weapons, which made them all terrorists, by the way, and according to the West. So that, at any rate, that's they murdered and they made a public show of his death. They also made a public show of the finding, locating, and destruction of Saddam Hussein. And we're in that kind of Roman stage for the Americans where they want to see people strung up that they don't like. And they always say, tut, tut. And by the way, they say, would you like to see more? And then they say, tut, tut. Then they say, would you like to see more? I think this is has to do with the need to humiliate and intimidate, they call it sending messages. So, as we said on the show last week, actually, the Russians did thwart the little show that they hoped to have. President Assad is now in Russia. Whether he will be a player or not, and will he be publicly speaking is a question, because generally when he's in the situation he's in, and Assad says that his position as president was basically null and void. If you don't have the loyalty of the army, if you don't have your party agreed to your presence, if somebody, and after all, we there is a natural democracy in all situations where people are told, no, you can't lead anymore. He says it's only nominal that he's president at that point. So he acceded. Now, he also said, I was the president who never abandoned the Palestinians. And he said, we provided assistance to those who were resisting Israel. He said, that's my record, whether anybody likes it or not. That is what he is proud of. He said he never surrendered on the point of sovereignty of the territory of Syria. This will become a question for the new guys, because, and so that's the Assad statement in my summary. Do look it up. Now, as to what happened and is happening, well, the New York Times and others have already begun to transform the gentleman, Giuliani, I call him, in that fun, gentleman. They transform him from terrorist to statesman. And I like the small details that CNN, for example, did an interview with him where they changed his costume. He used to wear, you know, a very intimidating guerrilla-style costume. Now he wears a sport jacket or kind of a cute sweater, and then he's a warm guy. It's amazing they didn't put him in front of a fireplace and feed the kittens while he's talking. They do so much of this is just plain show business. But at any rate, the woman from CNN who interviewed him made sure that she was wearing a scarf on her head while she talked to him. Very respectful. Contrast this with the fact that CNN made a great show that they wouldn't interview Iranian leaders if they had to wear a headscarf. So they said, oh, no, we're principled people. We don't, make women change their garb. But, you know, this is show business. So they said, well, you're going to have to, put on your scarf. So basically, it was just a lying, hypocritical display. But let's talk about him. He says that he's going to make a change. He's a nice guy. And we pointed on a show last week, talking to Atif Kubursi. Well, one thing for sure we know about him is he's a liar. And so for all I know, he might be a little nice guy, but he also puts on a costume and kills people. So what he's going to be tomorrow is yet to be seen. Maybe he won't be here tomorrow. I mean, that the situation in Syria is very volatile, very dangerous, in my opinion. But let's outline some of the views here. The foreign minister of Russia, Lavrov, says, well, to the Americans, their American counterpart, you, the United States, you said he was a terrorist. You said he's a wanted man with $10 million for his head. We also regard him as that. So are you telling us that you expect us to continue along with him at the head of a state? And are you going to say that he's a liberator? When will you test your new language regarding him? When will it be put to the Syrian people what type of government they want? How much free speech will there be? Because people, if you use the word liberate, you're indicating that people could say things now and take speak on behalf of the needs of their group, whether it be class or ethnic group or religious affiliation. When are these voices going to be able to appear without being intimidated by armed men? That would be the question. And Lavrov says clearly that such a person with his criminal record, it's criminal, that is, putting civilians to death by slitting their throats and filming it, they call that criminal. And so they are challenging, and very wisely, all the talk, because the rhetoric is going to be running about how wonderful it is. But they say, no, you can't have a government with such a person at the top. You have to show that the people want that person. And there's been no demonstration of that. What you've seen is a demonstration of military power, primarily from Turkey and Israel. It is what we're seeing happen to Syria is quite sobering, because it appears that there will be some type of balkanization, which is an old term for divide and rule, cut it into pieces. The most important military news from the region is that Israel has bombed very heavily. The numbers of bombs is really staggering. What they've done is they took out every military installation in Syria, destroyed it. And this is while that Mr. Jolani is telling the people that they're free, and Israeli tanks have, of course, entered now all of the Golan, and they're on Mount Hebron, if I got the name right. And they say this would be Mr. Netanyahu. He says, we've got it, and we're never going to give it up. And Turkey does nothing, which means there's some kind of unspoken agreement. And the people of Syria have no... Oh, and the Navy was destroyed. And there were no people there to defend it because they had been ordered to stand down. Which brings up a subject. Assad says that he was offered things. Basically, he didn't put the word bribe in, but if you read it, it's clearly saying that they offered him a lot of nice things if he would do what they wished, and he said he didn't cooperate. It would appear that some military people took the offer, because why did an armory stand down and take off? I don't know if listeners will know this story, and I hate to make this analogy, but you have to understand how much corruption there is. People talk about corruption's a happy topic. Everybody loves it. But when Fidel Castro was leading a guerrilla movement, a true one, by the way, an actual guerrilla movement, not financed by anybody except the Cubans. But when they really got the initiative, there was a famous confrontation, a test in eastern tip of the island, if I got my geography right, with a Cuban, a Batista military force. And very famously, because of the success they'd built up a treasury. And the famous Che Guevara, you can look it up in history books, he simply communicated to the opposing general, he said, "How about we give you $70,000 cash and you go to Miami?" And he said, "I'll take it." And so the general quit and his men surrendered, and it was a famous victory. In the case where Che did that, that was a smart move because he had a commander who could be bribed, and he took it. In this case, I'm only going to say there's a suggestion of considerable corruption. But more importantly, to go back, if we are a responsible country, I'm speaking of Canada now, a member of the United Nations, where is our voice saying, all right, there's an armed group in power led by a man who's on our list. So when will this person turn over decisions to the people? When will there be a referendum saying we want this leader? Revolutions do that, by the way. They do. Successful great revolutions have had a referendum base and took their issues to the people. You can study the French Revolution, find out that that is so. You can study any great revolution, actually, because they're not afraid of the people. They are very positive about the people, and positive that the people will endorse what they do. And then they'll give them the power to write a constitution. I suspect this constitution is going to be written in Washington, D.C., or Tel Aviv, or Ankara, and there's going to be an attempt to impose it. Syria is no more in this in any meaningful sense until these questions are resolved. And it's been pointed out, and it has to be, that there was a formula called the Astana process to which Iran, Turkey, and Russia were to see to it that a process that would reflect all the interests of all the people of Syria, maintain the integrity of the state, would happen, and that there would not be a settlement by arms. That has been shoved aside by those who did this, and their backers. They have said, we're going to, now we'll just do what we please. There's two places now where this is said. One is from Netanyahu. The other is from this man, Jolani. Neither of them have the right to impose anything on the Syrian people. My guess is there won't be a test. But remember, don't throw these agreements aside or think that treaties and negotiated processes can be ignored, because Russia is a member of the Security Council. They haven't agreed that this government can be recognized. It has to, if it wants to be a pariah government. Maybe the U.S. wants that because they often encourage pariahism. Maybe that's what they want to be, but they won't get away with it. Canada should be fighting for the preservation of the only institution that is internationally acclaimed and agreed to, the United Nations, which has a charter. And when there are agreements, and the United Nations endorsed the Astana process, so Mr. Jolani can say he doesn't believe it. That's too bad for him, because, and you know, Hemingway's line, take it from somebody else, no man is an island, no nation is alone. You can't be a state if other states don't want you to be a state. And so now we have a decision. Are we going to respect international law? Are we going to respect international treaties and particularly the UN Charter? Or are we going to fly by the seat of our pants and do it the way that Chrystia Freeland and the all-American presidents say we have a rules-based order, which everybody, including Canada, realizes that what they mean is America makes the rules. So it's America and NATO as rogues who think that they can ignore international institutions. And remember, the UN is made up of huge majority of people who are not white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. They are particularly the states of Africa, where we're seeing a lot of pushback against imperialism. You can't shrug them off. You can try, but you're not going to get away with it. We're back to a neocolonial order where France, United States, and their handyman, garrison state of Israel, say that they can impose. That's their doctrine. It's a dangerous doctrine. Canada should have nothing to do with it. We should be fighting for the maintenance of the United Nations to restore some authority there. And with Trump coming in, this is going to become an existential crisis, because like really most right-wing Americans, they regard the United Nations, as just a bloody nuisance that gets in their way, and they don't want to tolerate it. So we'll see what happens. But anyway, so now that's our news, that Assad has stepped down. He did not step down. He agreed for his security. And because there really was no longer any state capacity, he acknowledges you don't pretend to be a leader when you don't have a state, when you don't have an army. You all know the famous question attributed to Joseph Stalin. It's an apocryphal story, but it's a good story. Somebody said, the Pope is very unhappy with what you're doing in Poland. And he says, how many divisions does a Pope have? As I say, it's an apocryphal story. It's like the devil gets an awful lot of good lines, even though nobody's ever shown that the devil exists, but he's often quoted. again, this is the Tater Report at CIUT 89.5 FM. I think we've reached about the time. We're going to be coming up at 11:30 to speak to Ann Charney. I'll just introduce this bit of music by saying that Luigi Mangione has become, whether he wanted to be or not, a folk hero in the sense that he's raised the question of why Americans pay more than anybody for health care and find that their life expectancy is less than the people of Cuba. And it's a disgrace, and people are in pain, and they can't pay for their medicine, etc. As anybody who strikes out in any, whatever form, ends up with people saying nice things about them. And we have a case in point. His name was Pretty Boy Floyd, song by Woody Guthrie, and is sung by Joan Baez.